Coming to you live from Royal Albert Hall, it's the Hand Plus Broadcast, brought to you by Movie Change Up. Where each week, I, Joseph Fricke, and my co-host Tristan Mayer break down this week in streaming. We cover all your favorite streaming services, what you should watch, what you should avoid. We're here to just recommend shows for you. There's 500 streaming services, 500 new drops here every week, and we're here to just kind of tell you this is what you should watch, this is what you should avoid, like I already said. Tristan, I'm asking you the same question to start every episode. How is streaming this week? You have time to watch a lot of things? Were you just kind of watching the best of everything? How is streaming?
I had a mixed week this week on streaming. I had days where I was streaming all day long, watching stuff constantly. And then I had days on end where I wasn't watching anything. But I thought it was a pretty good week on streaming. We'll talk a lot about Netflix this week, which I'm kind of excited about, because even though Netflix is like the pioneer of streaming, I feel like they've slightly fallen off a little bit. So I'm happy to see Netflix coming in to give us some horror to kick off the horror season here. Many ways of horror, but yeah, it'll be a fun week this week. Some stuff to talk about, but yeah, I'm excited to talk about Netflix more than all the other platforms so far.
Awesome. So with that, without further ado, let's talk with probably Netflix's first rival in Hulu. Tristan, I know there's something on Hulu you watched this week. What was it?
Yeah, we talked last week about how we feel like Hulu is like irrelevant at this point. We don't really watch a lot of stuff on Hulu, so I made a point to go to Hulu and find an original that I thought would be cool to watch. And this was the one that I found, was called Reboot. It's a parody of a sitcom in a way, because it's about a cast of a really, really cheesy like 90s sitcom. Like, think Full House, think, you know, all of those cheesy ones you watched as kids. And now it's decades later and they're having to reunite and essentially film a reboot. You know, so we're in the era now of everything's getting revived. They have a scene in here where they talk about that. They're like, oh, are we still doing reboots? And they start listing off Fuller House and Saved by the Bell and Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and all the streaming platforms that are having their big reboot show. And this is meta in a way, because it's literally Hulu making this reboot. So it's kind of about Hulu saying, okay, we've lost relevance. Now we want to reboot this old sitcom to kind of like beat our rivals again. So it kind of played into our conversation last week of, is Hulu falling off? And we have a really good cast here with Johnny Knoxville of Jackass and Keegan-Michael Key of Key and Peele. And they play these kind of burnout one-hit wonder actors that are now having to come back and reprise these roles in this reboot. It's trying to be gritty and dark while still having like the same characters and the same arcs of the original show. It's very meta, and it's kind of like a behind-the-scenes drama about these characters and their rivalries and the actors and the drama of making a Hollywood show on top of the meta commentary of reboot culture. So I had a really, really good time with this. It's in the middle of the first season, so if you want to catch up now, it's a perfect time. They're only, I think, 4 episodes deep, so I definitely recommend it.
Yeah, I saw a lot of promos for it. It definitely looked interesting to me. I didn't get around to it. I just recently, like last week, got Hulu. I had a lot of things going on this weekend, so I wasn't able to get to watch it. But definitely going to 100% be checking this out, and we'll probably, maybe I'll talk about it next week when I watch the first couple episodes, and we'll probably be doing a season recap when it ends. But yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'd recommend it if you're a fan of episodes, the Showtime show, or BoJack Horseman on Netflix. Those both do kind of like the washed up sitcom star that is now having to revive the career. So I think if you're a fan of those and the humor in those, this has that kind of meta, slightly crass humor, not as crass as those two shows, but it's in there, you know? So I definitely recommend it for fans of comedy, people who are, maybe even if you're, whether you're invested in or tired of this reboot era, I think you're still going to have a lot of fun with it. It's not like punching down like, oh, look at these losers who want to watch rebooted cartoons or whatever, you know? It's very much like having fun with the industry on all sides of it.
All right, yeah, definitely interested in checking it out. And with that, I believe we're going to hop over to the OG of streaming, Netflix. And I just want to talk about some news. Netflix had that big Ta-Dum event. That's kind of like their D23 or kind of their big Comic-Con event. And one of the first things I wanted to mention was Beverly Hills Cop original cast members are returning for the Netflix sequel, which I believe would make this the fourth Beverly Hills Cop movie.
I was going to say fourth. I think it's the fourth Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, it's going to be. I think they took some inspiration with a title from Top Gun Maverick. This is going to be titled Beverly Hills Cop Axel Foley. Tristan, do you have any kind of feelings for this movie? I was never a big Beverly Hills Cop fan. I think I've seen the first one once or twice, and the second one once or twice. I don't even know if I made it to the third one. So it's one of those things where if it comes out and everyone says it sucks, I'm probably not even going to watch it. But if everyone comes out and it's like, wow, this is really great, I'll probably go back and watch the first three and then watch this. But I don't know if
you. Yeah, I don't have much nostalgia for the other movies. I've seen the first one a couple of times in my youth, you know, but not recently. And yeah, I'll be in the same boat as you. I do like catching up on old franchises, something I kind of enjoy. So as long as this doesn't completely suck, I'll probably watch the other three and then watch this. So yeah, I'll check them out. And good cast, so it'll be cool to see that cast back together, even though I don't necessarily have any love for the first movie. They do have a fun cast of actors in there.
Yeah, definitely. One of the other topics I wanted to talk about was Hemlock Grove, which I think was one of the first, if not the first, Netflix original series, is actually leaving Netflix on October 22nd, 2022. This is a Netflix original. It's not like another company owns the rights and are taking it away. Netflix 100% owns the rights through and through, and they're taking it off the streaming service. So a lot of these people that stopped buying physical media and are like, oh, it's on streaming, it'll be there forever. Well, even when the streamers own it, they take it off. So I figured you'd have a take on this as far as
a streaming you knew I would have a take on this.
Leaving the streaming service.
Yeah, these platforms really knew how to stand back and let HBO Max take all the heat for the last like month or two for doing pretty much this. You know, HBO Max did this for a lot of their stuff, and they're still doing it, especially for the cartoon side of it. But yeah, I don't think this is the last. I think they're trying to save money by not having to pay the residuals to these casts and these creators. So they're seeing the fact, they're going and looking at the numbers. They're saying, okay, Hemlock Grove, it was good when it launched and it was popular enough to have like a fandom around it. I remember having a bit of a following, but at this point, maybe people aren't watching it and the numbers aren't as high, so Netflix is just pulling it. And I feel like that's really a shame, you know, because like you said, it's not on physical media, I believe. Some of it might be, but Netflix doesn't tend to support physical media, so I don't think it will be. And it's a shame that a lot of these shows, once the platforms are doing the little calculations in the back room, like, oh, it's worth our tax refund, or it's worth our little bit of bandwidth we might save, or it's worth our little bit of renewal for the residuals on these casts to totally remove the show from all of existence. Like, that's pretty terrifying. The fact that you can't even go and buy it anywhere else, like, it's just gone, that's just really depressing, you know. And there's people out there who would watch that and love that eventually, you know. Maybe 20 years from now, someone will boot up Netflix and they would have watched Hemlock Grove and it would have been their favorite show of all time, but now it's gone forever, you know, and that sucks.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it'd be like if a senator, congressman with some gumption who really liked Hemlock Grove, really liked, could write it into the tax code that, yeah, you can take it off Netflix and you know, write it as a tax write-off, but then upload it to the Netflix YouTube channel, and then all of a sudden that's going to drive some traffic here, you know, for free to watch, and that's going to drive traffic to your Netflix YouTube channel, which ultimately drives traffic to Netflix, which is ultimately good for Netflix, but it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's like I said, it's going to be the beginning of a kind of floodgate of this, not from just Netflix and HBO, but I think we'll see this from a lot of places. And that's kind of the bubble of streaming bursting. It was nice when they were greenlighting like every single possible idea anybody had, and you're getting all these indie creators who were suddenly making huge budget movies and huge budget shows and having that huge career boost. But now it kind of sucks. They had that career boost, and now that really significant part of their career is gone forever, and they can't even watch their own work. That really sucks for them.
Yeah, definitely. It's one of those things. I wish there was more options, but it is what it is. And that brings us to some of the content we have from Netflix this week. And that is the first thing I wanted to talk about, which was Travelin' Band, the Creedence Clearwater Revival at the Royal Albert Hall, which is a documentary narrated by Jeff Bridges that kind of follows Creedence Clearwater Revival, which if you've listened to a classic rock station for an hour, you've probably heard one of their songs. They were big in the 70s.
If you watch any movie?
Yeah. Yeah, if you watch basically any patriotic kind of movie, one of their songs, especially a Vietnam War movie, one of their songs is played in that movie. But they hold basically one of their kind of quote-unquote claims to fame is they have the record for most songs to peak at number 2 on the Billboard charts, and also they never have had a song reach number 1 on the Billboard charts. So kind of a fun fact there. But anyways, the documentary is kind of a surface-level documentary. It follows just kind of the very broad generalization of the band and their origins and how they got to be big and how they got to be famous. And the documentary is probably, I think, an hour and a half. And the first half is the documentary part of, like, the band up to playing at Royal Albert Hall. And then the second half is just the previously unreleased footage or unshown footage of their performance at the Royal Albert Hall. So it's basically just like a concert film for the last half. So
interesting.
It's a fun, I think, kind of have on the TV while you're doing other stuff type of documentary. It's not like this hard-hitting, grounded documentary, but if you're kind of just want something on the TV to kind of check in and check out of, it's fairly interesting. Something you, if you have got kids, something you can have on while kids are in the house and not feel like that they're going to see anything inappropriate. And then, like I said, the last half of the documentary is literally just their performance. So that's kind of who I'd recommend it to. If you're a fan of the band, if you're a fan of the documentary, or if you're just a fan of music in general, check it out. But it's not going to, I think, change. If you're already a massive fan, it's not going to like change your perspective of the band. It's not going to change anything you wouldn't notice by reading the first two paragraphs of their Wikipedia entry.
Yeah, I'm curious to possibly watch this because I am a fan of the music, but I don't know anything about the band at all. So I feel like surface level, sure, but I have zero level knowledge of Creedence Clearwater Revival. So I think I would at least get some general understanding of the career and the highs and lows of it if I watch this. Do you think that would work for me?
Oh, yeah. I definitely think you don't need to know anything about the band going in. It's kind of just a general, their origins, how they came to be. Basically, they were performing and they had relative success, small success under a different name. And then they saw the Beatles and they were like, okay, we can kind of do it this way. And then essentially right before they did the Royal Albert Hall, the Beatles disbanded and they're like, all right, now it's our turn to take over, was kind of their idea. But yeah, that's the Traveling Band documentary. Worth checking out. And Tristan, I know you watched Blonde, the new movie on Netflix starring Ana de Armas as Marilyn Monroe. The only thing I ever saw they used to market this movie is it's NC-17. But
it's not actually on Netflix yet. It comes out, I think, tomorrow. With this week sometime it comes out, in the next couple of days. But it's been out in theaters for a couple of weeks, so I went and I saw it early to get the review out for us. And this was getting a lot of buzz. Her performance especially, people were kind of hyping her up at the beginning of the year. Oh, is she going to be the Best Actress nominee? Is she going to be a runaway win? You know, you're playing a historical movie actress, an icon. Is it going to be Ana de Armas and then Austin Butler? Are they going to be the two wins here? And Austin Butler seems like he's pulled through and is still kind of leading the chase, and Ana de Armas, not so much. And this movie is pretty divisive. I saw a lot of mixed scores. You know, I think it's at like a 53% on Rotten Tomatoes right now, so it's practically right down the middle. And when you watch it, you can see why. This is much more in the line of Spencer than it is Elvis or Bohemian Rhapsody. It's kind of like a tale with someone who is Marilyn Monroe, kind of, but it's a fictional story, and it's kind of a fable or a metaphor more than an actual like biopic about her career. And it plays much more like a psychological horror and kind of like this terrifying thriller more than it plays like a biopic. And it seems to have the thesis that the Marilyn Monroe persona that she has, that we know as the famous Marilyn Monroe, that was kind of a dark side to her, and that it was this kind of parasitic side of her nature, and that it was sort of tearing apart the good within her, while the Hollywood studio is kind of exploiting her and objectifying her and sexualizing her. And it really treats her as kind of like this sad story, similar in a way to how Spencer treated Diana, where she was kind of just a victim of everybody around her and didn't really have much autonomy in what she was doing. And she was desperately trying to have some autonomy and couldn't quite get it. And that's kind of the struggle of this movie here. It feels like it's showing Marilyn Monroe struggling to be independent, struggling to be taken seriously, struggling to be, you know, the independent, confident woman that we know her as, and while also showing kind of the brutal, really intense victimization of her by people around her. And it's NC-17 for a reason. It's very hard to watch at points. It's very, very vicious towards Marilyn Monroe in a way that I didn't necessarily appreciate, especially when you know it's so fictionalized and a lot of this violence did not happen in the way that it's portrayed at all. You know, when it feels in a way like they're using Marilyn to tell a story that isn't necessarily true to Marilyn Monroe's story. I'm right down the middle on this one, Joe. I don't know necessarily how to feel about it because the craft was so great and the horror elements in there are so interesting and so terrifying. But why is there horror elements in a Marilyn Monroe biopic? And I kind of wish they would have played this a little bit more straight. I appreciate crazy choices, but I don't necessarily appreciate crazy choices in the face of like a real person who actually faced a real life and real struggles. And I think they could have done a better job balancing the abstract with the literal here.
Is there anyone you'd recommend this to? Is this mostly for people trying to follow the Oscar race? Maybe just really kind of want to see movies that might.
Yeah, I think nominated. If you're a fan of like the surrealist film, it's very David Lynch-esque. You know, it's like this blonde woman going through the psychological terror. It feels like you watched Fire Walk With Me or Mulholland Drive and kind of took that very directly. It almost felt like watching Fire Walk With Me. And similar to Fire Walk With Me, I bet I'll watch this in a couple of years and be like, wow, that was actually really good. I was wrong the whole time, and I might turn around on this. But it's very abrasive and very kind of in your face. So if you're not into confrontational and somewhat surreal movies, you're not going to like this. So I could easily see people looking for a normal biopic being super, super, super let down. But if you're a fan of surrealism and your horror and taking a character that we know of Marilyn Monroe and saying something about the whole industry with that character, I think you'll like this.
All right. So what I've learned is if you're a fan of Suspiria, watch Blonde on Netflix. And but keeping with the trend of biopics and true life stories on Netflix, I know you watched the first episode of Monster, the Jeffrey Dahmer story. I know that was a big thing, a lot of people talking about on Twitter. So what was kind of your reaction to that? Is the hype real?
Yeah, I went for all of the divisive Netflix drops this week, I guess. But the first episode of Dahmer, I really did like. I thought this was very, very well made. The performances in this are incredible. And you've seen clips of it online where they're doing like exact recreations of courtroom scenes, but it's not as hokey as that might seem. These are very dedicated performances and really intense. And you see Ryan Murphy as the producer, and you wonder like, what kind of Ryan Murphy am I getting? You know, is this gonna be the campy, weird Ryan Murphy who gave us like Nurse Ratched and the one with Dear Evan Hansen running for class president? Is this going to be like a good show? And this is a good show. This is much more along the lines of the O.J. Simpson trial that he did, which was very much dramatic and very performance focused. And this is much more towards that side than it is towards like the American Horror Story Scream Queen side of Ryan Murphy. So if you're looking for a serious drama with great performances, this is it. I have mixed feelings on the show overall. We talked a bit about like Pam and Tommy and the Mike Tyson show on Hulu that were making stories about real people without permission of the real people and not necessarily in a respectful way. And we've seen a lot of the victims of Jeffrey Dahmer's family saying, we didn't want this show to be made. We don't want people to keep making shows about our family being killed. It's very traumatic for us and we don't like seeing it posted all the time online and people treating it like it's a popcorn show when it's about my actual brother being murdered, you know? And I think it's a hard thing to chew on. I think a lot of true crime shows deal with that moral issue of, are we glorifying this? Or are we kind of turning this into something more exciting than it should be? Or are we telling a story that should be told? And I think that's kind of the question that you ask when you watch this show. If you're into true crime, you're into this kind of genre, you're going to love this. But this is not going to be the one that turns you. If you think that's kind of a Nicky genre overall, this is going to be very icky. This is one of the more icky ones that I've seen in terms of turning. It's just kind of uncomfortable. And especially when you know that the family members of these victims have spoken out against it and they're still making it anyway, it just makes me feel a bit uneasy to watch. But if you can look past that, it's very well crafted, very well written, great performances. So I'm going to see this probably cleaning up at like Golden Globes and getting some Emmy nominations. I could see, you know, especially for the miniseries category, that's something that I could see them running away with. So watch it if you can look past the grossness.
All right. And speaking of gross things that make you uncomfortable to watch, and for very different reasons, I know you watched the Rob Zombie Monsters movie that just released on Netflix today. So
I could not help myself. When you put out a trailer that bad and you have such a combination, Rob Zombie plus Monsters, like, how am I not supposed to watch that? You know, I grew up watching the Monsters and I have a lot of nostalgia for the Monsters. Rob Zombie, I not so much. I've watched some of his stuff and I really like his Devil's Rejects trilogy. Those are all really fun movies. But outside of that, Lords of Salem, I also liked. I guess I'm a Rob Zombie fan. Now that I talk myself through it, maybe I'm a Rob Zombie fan. But yeah, you put two things I like together and you get something that is so, so absurdly bizarre. Like this is unlike anything I've ever seen. This is not like a Rob Zombie trailer trash take on the Monsters. This is pure camp. It's so, so goofy. Like every scene is goofy. The sets are all goofy. The costumes are all goofy. It feels goofier than the Monsters even felt when it was coming out. This is like so silly. And to see Rob Zombie's stamp on such a silly movie is just so interesting. The sets are so colorful. Rob Zombie loves to make like a really bright, colorful vivid set with so much in it, like stuffs his frame with things. You know, that's what I like about Rob Zombie movies. He like fills his, every inch of his frame has like stuff in it. And this movie is very much like that. All the sets are so stuffed with crazy decoration, but like, unfortunately the plot is just not there. The direction is just not there. It's just like stuff happening for an hour and a half without any real like narrative structure. And then it kind of ends, and it's telling this origin story, this love story of the monsters, but it doesn't really add much to the monsters' lore or to like the show. You know, I didn't watch this and be like, oh, I can't wait to go rewatch the monsters now that I've learned how they've gotten together, you know. But if you have some nostalgia for this and you want to see just this really, really weird movie, I don't know, I enjoyed this. I have to admit to you, I'm on the positive side of this not well received movie.
So
it's silly and it's goofy, but it barely squeezes into being enjoyable for me because of it.
So if you were not a fan of the monster, I mean, I know you don't really have any nostalgic care for the monsters, but if you don't have your taste in movies, if you're just an average person on the street, and if you're not a fan of the monsters, would you recommend this to anyone? Would you even recommend this to anybody, honestly?
I don't know if I'd recommend this to anyone, but I loved it. You know, it's one of those movies. I think if you can watch something silly and something goofy, especially like we're kicking off the horror season, this is something fun to start it off with, you might have a good time with it. You know, it might be a nice thing to throw in the background and to look at how goofy it is, to engage with the visuals a bit, and then, you know, give it that 1.5 letterbox review.
All right, that's fair. So I think that kind of wraps up our Netflix discussion, and we meant to talk about this before Netflix, but I completely missed it, and that's Amazon Prime. And we don't have a single topic to talk about with Amazon Prime, and that's kind of the problem. They have Rings of Power coming out. I'm down on it. I know Tristan likes it. But other than that, I looked at, hey, what did I miss on Amazon Prime? Let me go see what's dropped on there in the last week. It literally is like 5 things and nothing I even remotely cared about to watch. Most of them were just things that weren't even Amazon Prime things. It was just like movies or shows being dropped that weren't Amazon Prime originals. And I know they have Thursday Night Football that they have now every Thursday. But other than Thursday Night Football, and I will give them a shout-out for that, they have the most, the first day of Thursday Night Football, they had the most amount of people sign up for Amazon Prime in a single day than they've had in the history of Amazon Prime. So clearly they're doing something right, and I give them that. But as far as sustaining viewers, if you don't constantly having content, like even Netflix and Hulu, like the content may not always be top tier, but it's something that will interest someone. And if you don't even have content that you're dropping, how are you supposed to keep viewers? How are you supposed to retain an audience? And Tristan, I want to just have a conversation with you about it, of what do you think Amazon's model is?
Yeah, I think Amazon is definitely struggling to capture the mind share here. You know, outside of The Boys and I guess Rings of Power, they don't really have anything that people are talking about. And even Rings of Power, I'm liking it a lot, but it doesn't seem like everyone's engaging with it and talking about it and really loving it. You know, I'm enjoying it, but it's not going to be like my favorite show of the year. You know, I'm not going to be talking about it in my top 5 list of The Hand Plus at the end of the year. It's just very good, you know, and I think that's their struggle, is they need to get something that's great. They need something that's going to have everybody talking, everybody into it, and they haven't really had that yet. They had, once in a while, they'll get something out here that gives them some awards buzz. Once in a while, they'll have something like The Boys that has this really big niche and is popular in that niche, but they need something big. For me, I use Amazon Prime to watch other movies. You know, they have a really solid backlog of old movies, a lot of deep cuts for stuff that you wouldn't find in a lot of other platforms. So I like Amazon Prime. It has a really good selection of other stuff, but as for originals, they're just really not getting me.
Yeah, I think they were hoping Rings of Power would be that, but I think they dropped that at the worst possible time. I think dropping it at the same time as House of the Dragon and Andor was just the worst time, because I feel like the general people don't have time for like these like 3 or 4 water cooler TV shows. They were going to be locked in on Andor because as long as Andor was good, because people are going to love Star Wars no matter what. All the time, people are like, Star Wars is dead, Star Wars is dead. As soon as something good comes out in Star Wars, they flock right to it. House of the Dragon.
We'll talk about that soon.
And we're going to talk about Andor soon. House of the Dragon, Game of Thrones, the last few seasons weren't that great. But I think general populace, I would say if you ask more people what they care more about right now, Lord of the Rings or Game of Thrones, I think While Lord of the Rings has the bigger legacy and the movies in the early 2000s were massive and huge, I think more people care about Game of Thrones and at least the United States than they do about Lord of the Rings. And I just think putting a show, your Lord of the Rings show, toe-to-toe with Game of Thrones was just a big mistake.
Yeah, I don't know what they were thinking, especially when it's their only competitive show at all. Like, what was going through their head to do that? It's just such a bizarre choice to try and compete against such an established brand. And they're holding their own, I guess. Like, they're doing solid numbers, but I can't imagine maybe doing so much more if they came out like right after Game of Thrones went off the air. You know, imagine people are really up on Fantasy. House of the Dragon has a great finale, and then it's like, oh, next week, guess what? Lord of the Rings is on Amazon Prime. And maybe when we're at that point, we can look past some of the narrative stuff. We can be like, oh, you know, sure, it doesn't really make sense what's going on. I don't really follow the plot here, but you know, it's just more fantasy. I'm enjoying it, and I just don't understand why they did that, but the bad choice.
Yeah, I mean, their ratings can be whatever they say they are, but I just base ratings on what I see on Twitter the day it comes out and the day after it comes out, and I don't even fully remember what day Rings of Power comes out, because the only time I see people talking about it on Twitter is people saying, why don't other people watch this show? Or like,
yeah, that's the thing I always think of. It's like, when House of the Dragon drops, I'm sitting here like pressing the button, getting it ready to go immediately sometimes. You know, I do that for Andor sometimes. I do that for a lot of these shows, but Rings of Power, I'm like, I'll get to it when I get to it. You know, a few days later, maybe a week later, I'll get to it.
Yeah, I already said I'm out on it, but with a lot of these shows that I care about, I'll watch them. Like, House of the Dragon comes out Sunday, so I usually watch the Sunday right when I'm in bed about to go to sleep. And then Andor comes out tonight. I'm doing what I've done for all of these Star Wars and Marvel, the Marvel shows that I care about and all the Star Wars shows, is I set my alarm for 3:15 a.m. I wake up, I watch the show, I go back to sleep. That way I'm able to go on Twitter.
Yeah, I don't revolve my life around Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I'm able to get up and go on the internet the next day without fear of spoilers. But with that, I don't want to bury Amazon too much. I just question their business model. And I know if you're watching us on video, you see we have Andor above House of the Dragon. But I know we're going to spend more time talking about Andor. We're just going to have kind of a quick discussion on House of the Dragon, and then we'll move on to Andor. House of the Dragon, I think it's not better or worse than anything that's come before, any of the episodes that come before it. I think it's solidly on par. For me, I think pound for pound, first, I believe, six episodes of House of the Dragon versus first six episodes of Game of Thrones, I think House of the Dragon's still better. But one of the things I want to talk to you about is we had the big actor change this week. A lot of our younger cast, we had the big 10-year time jump, are now played by older actresses. And I just kind of wanted your thought. Do you think the casting worked? Do you think even if you didn't have access to IMDb, you would know immediately who's playing who? And do you think the actresses match up? And the actors,
yeah,
as well.
I think the actresses do match up. I think it's a solid casting for the time jump. But I do feel like this episode, I started to slightly see the seams a little bit in this show. I'm starting to slightly get nervous that they're rushing things a little bit. And I look back and I think that they could have spent a lot more time with the young cast, because I really, really liked them in the roles. And it's a shame to lose them, you know. And it was a bit of a jump to get to these new people, and the relationships changed a lot off screen, and that's a bit to adjust to, especially when the cast has changed so much. So I'm hoping that this first half of this season is a bit jumpy. I'm hoping they can stable out and like, this is our cast now, you know, this is our storyline. We're not going to be doing any more like 5-year time jumps. I need us to get to like a stable time here, because these time jumps are starting to leave a lot on the table of character development that's making me a little bit frustrated. Like, over the Christian Cole, why did he do the thing he did last week? You know, the violence of last week, we didn't really necessarily like get to explore that motivation in his head too much. And I think a lot of that's being lost in the time jumps, but this is still a pretty good episode, and I'm really into the show, and I can't wait to see more with the cast. Yeah, so I'm excited to see these new casts come into their own in the roles, because as of right now, they have big shoes to fill, because I really like the young actresses.
Yeah, I understand everything you're saying. One of the things is this episode in particular made this show remind me of a different show, and that's the miniseries from, I believe, the 80s, maybe the 70s, but Roots. Basically, you're following this one family through different timelines, and that's kind of, especially with this big 10-year time jump, and you're seeing character dynamics that were a little bit different than the last time we saw them. That's kind of very much what it reminded me of. Obviously, very different subject matter, but if in a post, like show interview, one of the creators, one of the writers, listed Roots as kind of like his writing inspiration of how to maybe format the show, it would not surprise me in the least.
Yeah, and I'm definitely a fan of it. Like, I think it's in the Game of Thrones nature that you're kind of playing catch up the whole time, you know, and there's like a lot that's happened before the Game of Thrones started, and you're kind of having to listen to the conversations and figure out the character dynamics and history through that. So I think it fits into the series, but I'm definitely hoping we slow down on the time jumps here, because there's a lot of narrative ahead of us. Let's not get too ahead of ourselves here, guys.
Yeah, I understand you on that point. And with that, or something else actually you watched on HBO Max, and that is DC's League of Super Pets. Basically, all of your favorite DC superheroes have pets, and I guess they fight the world. I guess somebody saw The Secret Life of Pets, and someone at Warner Brothers was like, hey, we own a property that where superheroes have pets. Let's make that movie.
That was exactly the inspiration. Like, you watch this, and it feels like Secret Life of Pets with, like, a shot of adrenaline into it. You know, they have superpowers, and they're kind of, like, in action once in a while, you know, so... It's more exciting than that movie was, and I was actually a bit impressed by this. But, you know, you're getting a lot of good DC jokes, a lot of fun in references for the adults. You know, it's not entirely a kid movie. If you're a DC fan, you're going to get some fun out of this. If you're just a general adult, you'll get some fun out of it. Like, the pet humor is really fun. If you've had pets in your life, you're going to get a lot of that pet humor. But overall, yeah, not necessarily one that's going to break new ground. It's not Spider-Verse type of movie where it's like, oh, everyone's got to watch this. It's animated, sure, it's a kids movie, but it's so good. And this is not that. This is a solid watch. I think if you're a DC fan, you definitely should watch it, because you're going to like it more than you might think you will. But if you're not a DC fan, you're just a random person who's like, oh, I like pets. I don't know if you're going to get much out of this. You either got to be a kid, have a kid, or be a kid at heart who loves DC stuff and can laugh at all of the references and the in-jokes. I'm a DC fanboy. You know, that's like my comic book brand that I obsess over. So I enjoyed it and liked it a lot. So I think if you're a fan like me, you'll like it. So I recommend it to them. Overall, not a recommendation for general audiences, I wouldn't say.
How was Keanu Reeves as the voice of this guy right here, Mr. Batman himself?
He was really good. They have a good cameo at the end, too, of an actor that is in DC movies that shows up. I don't want to spoil it necessarily, but Warner Brothers also uploaded it on YouTube before the movie came out, and it was a post-credits scene, so I don't know why they did that. But it is a really good cameo from some established DCEU characters at the end.
All right, yeah, because one of the things, so a little bit of a tangent here, but the Lego Batman movie... basically, when they announced that Will Arnett was the voice of Lego Batman, I guess that he would have been the voice of Lego Batman in the Lego movie first. And I heard that announcement, and I was just like, that makes no sense. I'm not about that at all. And then you see him in the movie, and I was like, honestly, if they were to make a serious animated Batman movie and bring in Will Arnett as the voice, I'd be 100% down. So I can't quite hear Keanu Reeves as Batman, but I want to check out the movie to see kind of how he sounds as Batman.
This is not as good as Lego Batman. Not as good as Lego Batman, but still pretty good. You know, it's still a genuinely fun watch, and I think a lot better than you might think it is. You know, I think, when I went into it, I thought I was going to be, like, stupid. You know, Secret Life of Pets, it's going to be really dumb and kid-oriented, but it was way better than I thought it was going to be.
All right, and I think that brings us to our final streaming service of the night, and that is Disney Plus. And our big episode, oh, I guess three episodes this week, was Andor. So one of the things I want to bring up first is when it first dropped, there weren't episode titles. It was just episode one, episode two, and episode three. And then I think 2 days later, I saw online, someone's like, hey, the Andor episodes have titles now. And I went back, they sure enough do. I think the first one's called Cassa, which I guess was Cassian Andor's birth name. But essentially... plot very much visually reminded me of Blade Runner 2049. And essentially the plot of the episode, you have flashbacks to Cassian now and then to his youth living on Canary. And he's looking for his sister who was left on Canary when he was taken as a child. And he's trying to find his sister, and it's getting into him a lot of trouble because apparently being born on Canary is something that will... bring interest from the Empire and bring interest from the bad guys. And He's very good at what he does. He works as a spy. He gets stuff off of Imperial shuttles, and that kind of intrigues one of the members of the rebellion, in a guy named Luthen. And he meets Luthen and eventually leaves with Luthen, and that's how the third episode ends. But Tristan, we got the first time a brothel has ever been just said straight up in Star Wars, and I wanted your thought, kind of, not necessarily, I mean, we can talk about the Andor episode in total, but how do you feel about the more adult version of Star Wars we're getting here, with the word shit being said in Star Wars, with the term brothel being said in Star Wars?
Star Wars fucks!
Yeah.
Here we go, Joe. It's officially canon. Sex exists in Star Wars. Right. Here we go, you know? I really like these three episodes, though, honestly. We've talked about in other shows the recent Star Wars stuff, and I've been kind of mixed on it, to say the least. I've been kind of down, to be honest, on a lot of the recent Star Wars stuff, and I came into this thinking, okay, I just need it to be good. You know, all I want is like a solid, entertaining show at this point, something that will get me back in the Star Wars universe and hook me in. And I thought this was great. I loved this so far. I'm so into this. I think this is the best thing that Star Wars has had probably since The Last Jedi has been out, and I'm really loving this. I think the world is so cool, and you talk about the Blade Runner aesthetic, and I think that's definitely here. You're getting that like ground level look at Star Wars that Rogue One did so well, but I think this is more engaging than Rogue One was. You're getting this very individual perspective on these people who are just trying to survive at the ends of society here. And I also love the pacing. Like, we didn't get to the Rebel Alliance in like the first episode. You know, I was kind of wondering, oh, are they going to like really quickly rush Cassian from the street rat to forming the Rebel Alliance because they want to get to that actual story, you know? And I like that they're focusing on Cassian's arc. They're focusing on the people around Cassian. They're focusing on building the world he's in, adding detail to the world, not just like showing up characters we already know or like ships we already know. We got a new droid. You know, I really like this a lot, and it warms my heart to be back into the Star Wars world again and to actually be like enjoying myself and not having to like caveat a bunch of things I hated about the episode. So yeah, I'm really into this, and I can't wait to see more.
Yeah, I'm definitely intrigued by it. I like the visual style. I really hope, I understand a lot of the problems with the visuals in both Book of Boba Fett and Kenobi were due more to COVID than anything else, and kind of changing their plans and forcing them to do things they didn't exactly want to do, force them to not shoot on location. But I definitely hope the look and feel of Andor forces them, the Dave Filoni and Jon Favreau, to increase the kind of visual look of their shows, because I think some of the times it looks great and other times it looks pretty rough, and there was no point to me in Andor where I was like, oh, this looks rough, this looks like a green screen, this looks like it was definitely shot on the volume. And I know there were a couple shots, I believe, that were shot on the volume, but pretty much all of it was shot on location. But I'm definitely intrigued where this goes. I saw the preview for tonight's episode, and that I think we're definitely going to be headed a lot more to the Rebel Alliance. We've seen some characters we've seen from previous works. I don't know, Tristan, if you saw it, but if anyone else hasn't seen it, I don't want to spoil it if they're trying to avoid any show spoilers. But one of the things I want to talk about was a theory I have. And you know, see a lot of it, and people are trying to construct what exactly happened in the past, because Marva refers, when she picks up Casa, when he's on that ship, when he's a young child, and she says, like, oh, they killed a Republic officer, but if you look, they have the Confederacy of Independent System, the Separatist logo on them. So people are like, well, that doesn't make sense. And then when he's an adult, they talk about on Canary the Imperial mining disaster, and they're like, but if he was taken off before, it would have been like, this was before the Clone Wars, apparently. How is it an Imperial mining disaster? So people are wondering, is this writing problems? Is this production problems? Like, is this the reason things aren't lining up, is because of just behind the scenes things don't gel? But I'm like, you would have had hundreds of people looking over this that I feel like someone would have caught. If they're a Republic, why do they have Confederacy of Independent Systems, the Separatist logo? And all these things. So I'm just,
I agree with you there. You don't accidentally put those on there. That's like a costume design choice, you know?
Yeah, so I'm curious what that was about. But one of the things I want to talk about is, I believe probably what happened, is my guess, is, because I did see something that explains it, is that logo predates, I guess, the Separatists, and the Separatists took that logo and adopted it. So I wonder if that's where that logo comes from. Is there part of the Republic, but maybe this part of the Republic branches off? But something happened in that mind, because it was all kids on their own. All kids on their own, and the adults are all dead in my theory and my thoughts. And if this is pre-Clone Wars, and Tony Gilroy has said that Andor is going to like change the way you see things, like the good guys aren't always the good guys, the bad guys aren't always the bad guys. My theory is, in a flashback that predates the other flashbacks that we have, are we going to see a Jedi, not necessarily one that we know, I'm not saying it's going to be Anakin or Mace Windu, but a Jedi is the reason that the mind shut down. Maybe some people in charge weren't using the mind for good, and they decided to shut it down, but something went wrong, and it's going to kind of view us as maybe view the Jedi in a bad light. And that's kind of my theory. What do you think of that? That someone or an entity that we have always viewed as good is going to be the reason Cassian's life got screwed up and all of the adults in that area of Canary are dead.
That's exactly what I was thinking was going to happen, Joe. I'm not going to lie. I'm on your exact level of thought here. I think it's going to definitely be a Jedi at the end, and I think it will be somebody we know. I don't think it's going to be like Anakin or Obi-Wan or somebody like that. I think it'll be like some kind of deeper cut Clone Wars character. I think that would be a lot more fun than just being like, oh, and here's Obi-Wan again. You know, I would love to see them grab somebody, even like a Plo Koon or something, you know? Ruin Plo Koon in the eyes of Dave Filoni. How would that make him feel, I think, you know?
Yeah, that would be fun. And then one of the, as far as the Imperial mining disaster, I just assumed after the Clone Wars and when the Empire started, that the Empire just went back to working on the mine and then something happened with the mine. I feel like that's just kind of the explanation of why you don't go back to Canary is the Empire went there, stripped it clean, and or something went wrong. I don't think the events of why the adults are dead and the Imperial mining disaster have to be the same event.
I'm kind of wondering if my theory was that the mine either mines out like a Kyber crystal or some kind of like Sith temple or a Jedi temple, something like that. And I could see them tying it all together in some way the Kyber crystals that they find on this planet could in a way fuel something in the Death Star. I could see that tying it together where Cassian's home planet kind of is like the thing that destroys him in his death. You know, that was the theory I also had, that they found some kind of weapon or some kind of like Kyber crystal type of thing on this planet. I know there's some kind of canon explanation for like where they got the Kyber crystal in the Death Star, but I don't know what it is. I'm sure you might know. Deep cuts than me.
Various planets. It's all but confirmed. I don't know if it's ever actually been 100% confirmed, but it's unofficially confirmed that, you know what Starkiller Base is, right? Like what planet that actually is.
Yeah, I've heard that theory.
Yeah, so it's
a really, I mean, that's not even a theory at this point. That's just like,
yeah, it's been confirmed. So anyone that doesn't know, Starkiller Base, the planet in the end of The Force Awakens that has a big strip ripped out of it, is the planet that the Jedi got their Kyber crystals from, and the Kyber crystal is the thing inside the lightsaber that powers the lightsaber and makes the lightsaber work. And so we've seen that planet in one of the arcs of the Clone Wars, and it appears in the Jedi Fallen Order video game. And so it's a very important planet. So for me, that's where they got a lot of their Kyber crystals from. But you can get Kyber crystals from more than just Ilum. We saw Ezra get one on Lothal. So potentially Canary could be another planet where Kyber crystals are from, and that could potentially be why people from Canary are a person of interest to the Empire. But another
And I would imagine that the Empire would kill off any people who knew that it was there, right? And that could be why all the adults in Canary are dead, because they were executed because they knew where the Kyber crystals were at, and the Empire wanted to get them for themselves. That's my theory.
Ooh, that's a good theory. Ooh, maybe a Jedi went there because they viewed it as evil if you're stealing our Kyber crystals, and they went there to stop the Kyber crystal theft, as they viewed it, by the Confederacy. Because we know that the Death Star plans existed pre-Clone Wars, because we saw Count Dooku present Pago the Lesser in Attack of the Clones, the diagrams for the Death Star. So, like, that could be their, so we knew they were starting it. We knew they were doing that before the Clone Wars. So maybe Maybe Count Dooku. Maybe we get, you know, we're talking Jedi and it's going to change how we do the Jedi, but maybe we just see a flashback and it's Count Dooku and he's like, all right, I got all the kyber crystals I need for this thing. And they, he lights it up and cuts him down, mows him down.
I love that you pulled Pablo Lesser out of there. I was like, wow, Joe, you really know your characters.
Hey, I know things about Star Wars, but another topic I wanted to bring up was, so in the Rogue One Visual Dictionary that I actually have back here, they list Cassian Andor's home planet as Fest. And if you look at before Wednesday, if you looked on Cassian Andor's Wikipedia page, it would have said he was born on Fest. And now they've in-universe changed that. Oh, he was actually born on Canary. We just changed his documents to say he was on Fest and no one knew he was born on Canary. How do you feel about those in-universe changes? Do you really care? Do you mind that it changes canon from a visual reference book?
I don't care necessarily, especially when they offer like a fun little plot explanation. You know, it's kind of like Star Wars where they're like, oh, you know, from a certain point of view, that's true, you know? And I think it's kind of the fun of this massive, ridiculously big universe is that they're like somehow working in these ridiculous changes. And even like the tiny minutia of like, oh, what about the Rogue One Visual Dictionary? It has to fit. And it's like, I like that they sweat the detail of that, of being like, okay, we're going to make it fit. We're going to figure out how to fit the Rogue One Visual Dictionary into the Cassian Andor TV show. I think that's just part of the fun of this massive, between books and comic books and shows and movies, having to somehow make that all work together is kind of the gimmick of Star Wars. So I have a lot of fun when they have that little tiny explanation in there.
All right. Yeah, I thought I had it back there. I couldn't find it. I was going to try to pull it up and see where it specifically says Fest in there. But also, how do you feel about the actress Fiona Shaw raising kids who aren't her own? I think she did a little bit better of a job with Cassian Andor than she did with Harry Potter, but...
Yeah, it went better this way than I think it did in Harry Potter. Although Harry Potter did, you know, he saved the world or whatever, you know, so maybe it worked out well.
Yeah, she raises kids that save the world, so that's something. But a little bit nicer of a human being in this than in...
Yeah, a little bit kinder, you know. Petunia had her trauma, but, you know, a little mean to Harry.
Yeah, it's also curious how they're going to work in the line that Cassian says in Rogue One, I've been in this fight since I was 6 years old. What does he consider this fight? Are we considering just him being on his own? Are we going to just assume that his birth parents died in the Canary, whatever event took place that killed the adults on Canary happened when he was six?
Yeah, I think the flashback we're seeing of him when he's a young kid, you know, I think that's important. That's going to kind of be like his entry into the fight, you know, and... Even though it wasn't necessarily a fight for the rebellion, it was still a fight against like the oppression of the Empire, right? Like this first episode, he was already being oppressed by these law enforcement officers who were profiling him and ready to rob him and all that kind of stuff. And even though it's not a fight against the actual, specifically against the Empire, it's against the ideas of the Empire, right? It's against the ideas of oppression, against the ideas of inequality. And I think he's saying, look, I've been fighting for this my entire life, even under different names, whether it was the Empire, whether it was this or that, I've been fighting for this since I was essentially born, you know?
One more thing I wanted to bring up was Tony Gilroy, the creator, and well, I don't know if he's actually technically the creator, but he's the current showrunner of the show, and he did a lot of the reshoot directing on Rogue One, has said that it's called Andor, but it's very much a two-hander show between Andor and Mon Mothma. And we have the recent news that James Earl Jones is retiring from the role of Darth Vader, and it's now going to be handed over with his permission and everything. And he even worked with them on the lines in Kenobi of the Respeecher technology. So basically, AI is going to be voicing Darth Vader using James Earl Jones's voice. Part of me wonders, is that because the Respeecher is going to be brought back again, and we're going to be having Darth Vader appear in Andor? Maybe not, I wouldn't say talking directly to Andor, because I don't think that would work, but maybe more dealing with the Mon Mothma side of the storyline.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think it's probably because, you know, he's getting very old, and I think he's gotten to a point where he can't necessarily do tons of lines, you know, and the fact that this technology exists means he doesn't really have to keep coming in, you know. And if they're going to do a lot of scenes with Vader in this series or in future series, I could see him showing up in Ahsoka. I could see him showing up in a lot of other shows that have been set up here. I could see them needing to be like, look, we have a lot of lines for Vader. James Earl Jones is not necessarily of age to be doing all these lines. I think it's time to let him retire, and we can just keep going on with our editing software version of Vader.
Yeah. Honestly, it didn't
sound... don't know how I feel about that, but...
I mean, he's for it. He supports it. He says he's down with it, and he You know, he likes it. So if he's okay with it, then I'm okay with it. I think if he wasn't alive anymore, then maybe it's a little bit icky and a little bit gross. But when he hands it over and says it's okay, and and I didn't really notice the difference when Kenobi came out. I know a lot of people didn't even notice that they were using a technology. They just thought it was James Earl Jones back voicing Darth Vader. And one of the things I want to shout out that the re-speecher technology, the people who did the voice in Kenobi for Darth Vader, it's a Ukraine-based company, and Lucasfilm reached out when everything was going down and they were still working on the Darth Vader voice. They were like, "Hey, we understand there's a lot going on over there. If you don't want to do it, we can have another company do it, blah blah blah." And they're like, "No, we're the best at it. We want to show the world we're the best at it, and so we're going to keep doing it regardless of everything going on around us." And they did it, accomplished it, and I think they did a great job. So shout out them. Shout out to the people at Respeecher.
Yeah, Star Wars is all about, pioneering a new technology, and I'm happy to be that person who's like, "Oh, I hate this," and then in 10 years being like, "Oh, it's very cool, actually."
All right, I think that kind of wraps up our Andor discussion, and probably our next topic we're going to is our last call, essentially movie or show leaving streaming. And I'll do mine first. So mine, we got news. We're getting a Constantine sequel, and movie starring Keanu Reeves as John Constantine, a British DC character who kind of goes against demons and things from hell. His comic series was called Hellraiser, so, or Hellblazer rather. And so yeah, that movie, I think good movie, a little bit underrated, definitely worth checking out if you're into kind of dark, mystical movies and shows, and you haven't checked out Constantine. Check out Constantine. It's leaving Netflix in early October, so.
Yeah, I'm looking forward. I haven't seen Constantine actually, so I'll definitely be checking it out. It's one of those movies that got kind of trashed when it came out, and it's been getting kind of revitalized, and people are saying, "Oh, Constantine not as bad as they made it out to be." So it's one that I've been meaning to watch, and now's my excuse to watch it.
Yeah, I think 4 or 5 years ago, I saw a video clip the other day of Keanu Reeves was on, I believe, Conan, and Conan said, like, there's all these reboots, and they're bringing, maybe it was like early promotions of Bill and Ted Excellent Adventures, might have been what it is, like when that was first announced, they were doing that. And I guess Matrix was coming back, and they asked him, if there was any other character you could bring back and do again, what would you do? And he said, "John Constantine." So I'm excited we're going back to it. I enjoyed the movie, so.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to watching it. And for me, my last chance pick here, kick off your horror season a little bit early with The Empty Man on HBO Max. This is also one that came out, didn't get a great reception, didn't really make a lot of money, but people, once it dropped on streaming, people were like, "Oh, wow, Empty Man's great. You got to watch Empty Man." And it's leaving HBO Max at the end of the month. So definitely check it out. We talked about stuff that is not necessarily available on streaming being gone forever. And Empty Man is one of those cases. It's a movie that didn't get a huge physical media release. It's not available on Amazon, anything like that. You can't buy it. So once it's off HBO Max, it's gone until it pops up somewhere else. The only way I was able to buy it is I bought this Redbox version of the Blu-ray. Oh, not even a Blu-ray, it's a DVD. So I had to buy the Redbox DVD out of the Redbox machine. And that was the only way I was able to get The Empty Man. So if you want to watch The Empty Man before it's potentially gone forever, check out HBO Max. It's already out of the Red Box, so sorry, but watch it on HBO Max. It's a really, really good, a great, like, long horror movie to kick off your horror season.
All right, and that brings us to our last two topics of the day. What do you want to do first, MVP or winner of the week?
Let's do MVP. I wonder if we'll be unanimous on this one, because I have a pretty solid pick for mine.
All right, our MVP 2 weeks ago, we had Dan Campbell from Hard Knocks. And then our MVP last week, we had Emily Carey, who played Allison Hightower in House of the Dragon. So my MVP this week, I'm very curious to see who you went with. And my choice relates to our last topic, and that is Tony Gilroy, the person who said, "This is how you should be doing Star Wars on TV. This is how it should look." Not necessarily how it should feel. I think there's room for all kinds of diversity of tone in Star Wars, but as far as visual production, I think I didn't see one negative thing about Andor when it came out. And a lot of the complaints that people have had about recent Star Wars, especially the writing and the visual aesthetic of it, of as far as quality, he just said, "Yeah, I'm not worried about that." the episodes were written great and they looked incredible, and I think I was just forced to. I had to go Tony Gilroy.
Yeah, I had mentioned that I thought you might have the same answer. I thought we might have been on the same page for this MVP this week, and we were. My pick was Tony Gilroy. He was like, you know what, Star Wars sucks now, let's make it good. And I think he did a great job with that, you know, and it showed in his work on Rogue One that he was able to see Star Wars from a bit of an outside perspective and be like, let's make something a bit different. And you don't exactly know what changes he made, but if you look into it, you can figure out what scenes were shot before he came out and what scenes were shot after and see what changes he made. And I think it shows in this that he loves Star Wars, but he is not attached to Star Wars. You know, he loves the world of Star Wars. He likes the kind of aesthetic and the look of Star Wars, but I don't think he's like, oh, it's got to be Luke Skywalker. It's got to be this. It's my childhood. You know, he likes Star Wars, but he's not obsessed. And I think that helps. This show just looks so ridiculously good. And I spent the whole like first episode, maybe even two episodes, waiting for it to like all of a sudden look like shit, you know, because it's like I'm used to Star Wars looking bad for the last few years. But it's so impressive, and I hope that he leads the way. Like you said, I hope he can inspire Dave Filoni and Favreau to kind of up their game. I hope he can inspire Kevin Feige to up his game on the Marvel side. I really think this show is, it's really like warmed me and made me feel like Disney Plus can actually create something on the scale of like a Rings of Power, you know, or a House of the Dragon if they wanted to.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things, and I'd be down if like Star Wars moving forward, I think ultimately it's going to be hard pressed to find a filmmaker, especially who wants to work in this genre, who wasn't inspired by Star Wars and who doesn't. But I'd be down if in the future they actively searched out good filmmakers who don't care about Star Wars, let the story group go in and make sure everything connects and everything, you know, nothing goes against canon or breaks canon. But I'd rather have more shows like Andor of, and it doesn't have to be this tone. I'm not talking about this tone where they can say shit and say brothel. They can be like shows aimed at 12-year-olds. If the Duffer Brothers come in or like, oh, I don't really care about Star Wars, but I watched a few things of Star Wars and I have an idea for a show about a young Padawan, then great. But then shows or like movies like Rogue One, like I had this thing where, you know, like Jumping the Shark or Nuking the Fridge, where a movie or show kind of loses what it's originally about after a big event. And for me in Star Wars, what I think about is Hovering on the Blue Milk, where you're doing a thing as a reference. It has nothing to do with the story you're telling. It's just you showing the fans that you've seen the previous movies. And Andor didn't have any of that. There was like a moment where they looked at a Bantha doll, but it was reference to his own childhood and his own life. It wasn't just like, oh, here's a Bantha. You remember Banthas from A New Hope.
Yeah, I think a lot of the Star Wars shows feel like they expect you to have watched Star Wars. You know, it feels like all the characters and the directors have all watched Star Wars, and this just feels like a show set within Star Wars. And Tony Gilroy is the reason it looks like that and feels like that. So he's my MVP by a mile.
Yeah, Tony Gilroy. I was trying to think if is there anyone else, and I was like, no, it's Tony Gilroy. And I like how a lot of times, you know, this is our first behind-the-scenes person. We had someone who was the star of a documentary. We had an actress behind House of the Dragon, and now we actually have a behind-the-scenes person. So curious to see who's going to win next week. And so our MVP this week is Tony Gilroy. And that brings us to our winner of the week, and that is what streaming service do we think won the week? And let me break down who has been our previous winners of the week in the month of September. So we both agreed Amazon Prime won the first week of September. I feel like they had a bunch of, oh no, that was when Rings of Power debuted. Rings of Power debuted and I think the first two episodes, and we're like, oh, this is going to be a big show. We're kind of probably wrong about that, but they won the week. Week two of September, Disney Plus won. Don't really remember why they won, but we felt like Disney Plus was deserving. I think it was a big news week for Disney Plus that week.
Yeah, it was Disney Plus day that day,
I believe. Yeah, Disney Plus week that week. And last week, HBO Max won, probably just because House of the Dragon was good and they had some other good drops. And so this week, we have to determine who won. I think, honestly, it's between two for me. I think HBO Max is out. They had House of the Dragon's just still good. Got it. Okay. Hulu, they had reboot, but other than that, they didn't really have much. Hulu's best stuff for me is mostly their FX Hulu crossover stuff. And then I think Netflix is another option. Monster, the Jeffrey Dahmer story, was all over Twitter this weekend, all over social media. I really enjoyed the Traveling Band documentary. And so I think if, and then Disney Plus had Andor, the first three episodes of Andor, which were big and popular. And for me, I think it would come down to Monster, the Jeffrey Dahmer story versus Andor. And I feel like Monster, the Jeffrey Dahmer story, in a way, is just another good true crime documentary or true crime show on Netflix, which they are very good at, where Andor was more like, hey, Star Wars could be back. Like, it wasn't really out because it wasn't, like, super bad. It hasn't been super bad for a long time, but I think fans who maybe have started to pull away could have brought him back and revitalized their spirit and hope for Star Wars. And so I think overall I'd have to give my vote to Disney Plus.
For me, my vote is going for the former there. I think Netflix had it this week. They dropped some really, really different stuff. I love the variety that Netflix dropped this week. We had Blonde, this really divisive, really strange. And people talked about the Jeffrey Dahmer show, but I saw a lot of talk about Blonde. A lot of really intense opinions, a lot of intense thoughts. And I think once this actually does drop on Netflix, it's technically a day early on this, but I think the fact that it's going to drop tomorrow, people are going to be really having a lot of strong opinions on this. And the Dahmer show, people were really talking about it, really strong opinions, a lot of discussion. The Munsters movie, it didn't hit when it dropped, but people were talking about it when that trailer came out. People were like, how bad is this thing going to be? And it's been getting a lot of really fun negative reviews online. So for me, Netflix won the week. It had such a strong variety of weird stuff, you know, an NC-17 surrealist horror movie with Marilyn Monroe in it. We had a Rob Zombie Monsters reboot. Like, what a weird combination of things. And I think that's just the exciting part about streaming. You can drop whatever you want. You can do an NC-17 movie. You can do a Monsters movie. You can do a Dahmer miniseries all in one day, you know, and that's Netflix. So for me, Netflix for the week.
All right, that makes sense. I'm okay with that for your pick. With MVP, we both try to find a consensus MVP, and we both had the same person in mind, so it was an easy discussion, easy decision, Tony Gilroy. But winner of the week, we're allowed to have our own winner of the week. Obviously, my pick is Disney Plus. Tristan chose Netflix. I think both were the options, were the picks, and that is why Netflix and Disney Plus are winners of the week. And with that, next week, I think we'll be doing our October preview. It'll only be October 3rd. We'll be back to Monday. I just had too much going on this weekend and too much going on yesterday to do a show yesterday. Tristan, I know, is busy as well. And so next week we'll be back to Mondays, I believe.
I can't wait. It's going to be a great October. You know, I love horror movies, and it's going to be a horror-centric month for us. So I can't wait for it. Hellraiser drops this week on Hulu, so I have a Hulu movie to review. It's going to be a great month, Joe. My favorite month of the year.
All right. Someone has to like this month. I don't hate it. I just... not my month. And without further ado, I think that wraps up our show. So, goodbye. Hey, thank you for watching the Movie Change Up podcast. We'd really appreciate if you liked, commented, subscribed, and shared us with anyone you think might be into what we're doing over here. Thank you. Have a nice day.